Session number 9851, Robert Watteau Burdett, Part 1.
Where were you born, Mr. Burdett?
I was born in London. Paddington, actually.
But you were saying your parents weren't English.
My parents were both French, and they came over here in 1905. My father was a hairdresser, ladies hairdresser, and my mother was a dressmaker. And in those days, of course, French people were very popular in those particular professions.
Were you schooled in London?
Yes, I was schooled in London, and but I had 4 years in France during the First World War, 1916, for 4 years, and I came back and I finished up at the Polytechnic in Regent Street. I think that's been abolished now. I was supposed to be a mining engineer, but my father was very strict. He said, "You're going to be a mining engineer." As soon as he mentioned that, it put me right off.
What did you become?
Well, too many professions to tell you. I did about 21. I worked it out the other day, about 21 things. I went off to, left home at 17, I went to Monte Carlo and became a cloakroom attendant, and I worked in Paris at Fouquet's Bar as a groom, and eventually I went back to England and I was 18 and became a ladies' hairdresser. And I did this for 10 years. Of course, at 20 I was called up in the French army, father being French. I did my national service in Beirut. And at the age of 24, I went to Kenya, where I opened, I managed a hairdressing business there. And then after my 3 years contract, I went in for gold mining, Kisumu, near Victoria Lake.
What about on the outbreak of the Second World War? What were you doing then?
Well, I happened to be in London on holiday from Kenya. The war broke out. I thought, I was called up by the French consulate, and I thought, it's only going to last a few months, might as well join up. You know, I was quite happy, a little adventure. I couldn't join the British Army. They wouldn't take anybody over 27 in 1939. I was already over 30. Then, of course, after the collapse of the French on the 15th of June 1940, I got demobbed and came back to England. But it took me a long time. Had to walk halfway through Spain. I walked as far as Barcelona, and of course I still had my British passport, although I was in the French army. And there I was given a ticket to Madrid, Madrid to Badajoz, and then I walked another 30 miles into Portugal. Eventually got back to Lisbon, and I was put on a boat. I had to work my passage as a deckhand, 6 weeks on the boat and in the convoy, and got back to England.
How did you come to join SOE?
Well, it's a long story, really. I didn't know what to do. I didn't particularly want to join the army. I wanted to get back to Africa, where I had a gold mine. But I divorced my wife. I had custody of my child, a little girl, 10 years old, and I thought I'd get back to Africa. Couldn't get back. I did have permission to go, but no berths available. And one day I was walking down Piccadilly, and I met an old friend, started talking about the war and this and that and the other. He said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I've got to do something. I can't get back to Africa." So this is his exact words. "Well, old chap," he said, "they're looking for some silly buggers like you to parachute into France." He said, "They've asked me." He said, "I'm not mad, but you might be interested." So I went straight to the war office, and a couple of months later I was in the SOE.
Who was this chap?
Oh, I don't remember now. The man I met?
Yes.
No, I don't remember. Talking about 50 years ago, nearly. Just a Frenchman whom I knew.
What did they want to know about you when you volunteered?
The war office. Yes. Well, I went to the war office, and very discouraging. I filled up a few forms, saw a major. I said, "Well, I understand that you need people who speak French to parachute into France." "Oh," he said, "everybody speaks French." That was a stupid thing to say, because everybody doesn't speak French. I said, "But I speak French like a Frenchman. I mean, I know the slang." "Oh, well..." Very discouraging. He was just testing me, actually. So I said, "All right." And I was walking out of the door, and he said, "Oh, just a minute. Here's an address here, Major Gielgud." He was married to a French woman. "You write to him." So I wrote to Major Gielgud, and of course, within a few weeks, I was in it. That was that.
Why should he have been testing you in that way, do you think?
To see if I was genuine, probably, I should imagine. Because... Of course, there could have been also spies, the fifth column, we called it in France, trying to get into the organization. That's possible.
What happened when you saw Gielgud?
Well, we had a talk about things, and within a couple of weeks, I had a letter asking me to join.
Can you remember what Gielgud wanted to know?
No, well, just about my past and my life, what I had done and who my parents were and what connections I had in France, which I didn't have any because I never really lived in France, apart from 4 years at school when I was 14, when I was 10.
But you knew right from the start that it involved parachuting in
France? Oh, well, I volunteered for that, yes. But not all the people knew, because what they did, they recruited people from certain regiments who could speak French. There was about 20 of us in this particular group, and not all knew what they were being trained for. And at the end, they were all interrogated when after we'd finished their training, because I knew, because I volunteered for that. And most of them accepted, but I remember one in the group did not accept. He didn't know that he was going to be parachuted to France.
What made you volunteer for such a dangerous job?
Well, it's just a spirit of adventure. I've always liked adventure. To me, it didn't seem dangerous. I mean, I was like a Frenchman. In France, I was a Frenchman. I was small, dark, spoke fluent French.
What did you think about the Germans?
Well, we didn't. Where I was in Lyon for 18 months, we had no Germans. Not for 18 months, I'm sorry. The Germans, I jumped on the 1st of June, and the Germans didn't come in until November. We had no trouble with German soldiers. It's only the Gestapo and the SS who were looking for people like myself.
So, but you didn't volunteer because of a particular hostility towards the German regime?
Well, a little of that, really. But as I say, I liked adventure. And to me it seemed quite a nice, excitable thing to do, blowing up trains and things.
What about the training that you got? Did you find it adequate? Were you satisfied with it?
Oh, yes, yes. Well, yes and no. A lot of stuff which I thought was rubbish in the training. For example, they taught us how to bury a parachute. Now, you can imagine, you jump into France by moonlight, either the Germans or the French police have seen us jump. We're not far from a village. You're not going to spend half an hour digging a hole to pay a parachute. At least I didn't. I just folded mine up and threw it in the bushes. And that's that. And also another thing I thought was rather stupid. Every night, of course, the wireless operator was in contact with London. We sent a message, and the next day they would send the answer to our messages. So we'd meet that wireless operator in a cafe, and have an aperitif, of course. That's nothing unusual in France. 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock, meet in the cafe, have an aperitif, and he would offer me a cigarette. Now, I don't smoke. Then he would give me a matchbox with matches in to light my cigarette. In the matchbox was a message. I'd open the matchbox, take out the message. Well, that seemed a bit stupid. All he had to whisper, you know, not even whisper, just talk. I got a message from London. Your next dropping zone has been accepted. Everything's okay, that's all. I mean, nobody's going to hear him say that. I mean, passing messages in a matchbox, I mean, I think the job's for the boys, I call it, trainees. But otherwise, the practical side, I mean, the explosive side, I thought that was very, very good. And we had things to do for testing us. For example, I was told to go to the, what is it in Bristol? Is it the Blackwall Tunnel? In Bristol, isn't there a tunnel there?
The Severn Tunnel.
Is it the Severn Tunnel? That's right. I was told to go in there, and I spent the night in there to see what I could do, what damage I could do. And I could have done a lot of damage if I'd been an enemy agent. And little things like that. Then I was sent to, I think it was Portsmouth, on a second test job, exercise, to get a job in a factory. I got a job in a factory, and I worked there for a week in an aeroplane building factory to find out what I could about where the different parts came from, because if we found out, say, a factory that were making a certain part which was very important to the plane or whatever, and we could blow up such a factory in France, of course that would stop the building of the planes maybe for a few weeks or even a few months.
So you came back from the Severn Tunnel and the factory with a report about what you could have
yes,
done?
Yes, that is true, yes.
Rather than having actually practically done something.
Oh, no, well, I wasn't going to blow up not in England. The only thing I didn't like about the factory, I had to get up at 5 in the morning. That was the worst part of it, and it was cold. It was the snow on the ground.
Can you remember any personalities you were on training with?
Sir John McGill, he was our training officer. I think he's dead now. Sir John McGill was his name. And, well, I can't remember. The first place was at Guildford, but I can't remember the names now.
Or any of
the... Of course, Buckmaster was our boss, and De Galis was one of the men, but I think he's also dead. He got killed in a motor car accident. I can't remember the names now.
Did you have much to do with Maurice Buckmaster?
Oh, yes, a lot. I still see him every year. We have a dinner every year, 14th of July. Unfortunately, this year he wasn't able to come. He's getting old, and his wife is very sick. Otherwise, I see him every year. We have a meeting there. Well, Cormo, she organises a dinner, the 14th of July.
What did you think about Maurice Buckmaster's role?
Oh, very nice chap, yeah. Yeah, it's a very important role and a very nice man. Very pleasant.
Can you tell me about your preparations for going over?
What do you mean, going over to France?
Well,
the clothes was an important thing. Everything had to be checked up. There was no thing in the back of the shirts, coming from France, coming from England. All their things, shirts and everything, had to have a little tape, from Paris. Nothing special. We just met at the I forget where we went from, Manchester. Now I jumped on the first June with another man. He was only 20, very tall, 6'2". Bob Shepherd was his name, very fair. And I said, I'm sorry, I don't think you'll last long. You look too much like a British officer. And he was caught straight away. He jumped on the roof of the house next to the police station. We were 30 kilometres from Lyon. He got caught straight away. Spent the whole of the war in prison. I got him out of prison. He was sick at Christmas time. And I got him out there with the help of... A local guard who was sympathetic towards us, and sent him back to England through Spain. But he was caught on the Spanish border, and he finished the war in Mauthausen. But he's still well. He's living in France. He's quite happy and well.
Do you think it was his appearance that was responsible?
No. He jumped on the roof of the house next to the police station. He was caught straight away. As the police, of course, saw a parachute drop, and he was caught as he left the house. But he would, I don't say that, I mean, this is just a joke, but it could have, it was against him, wasn't it? Because if I said I was a British officer, he would have laughed at me. Small and dark and nothing like what they expect a British officer to be. They always expect British to be tall and fair, which is not always true, of course.
Can you tell me about what it was like going over?
Well, nothing special. I mean, we had a hole in the bottom of the plane there, and the sergeant said, "Get ready." And we put our legs over the hole, said, "Go!" And we jump, and within 9-10 seconds, we were on the ground. And I had 8 jumps altogether, and I never hurt myself. But we did have a man. I received a man in 15th of August in Marseille, 1944, and he broke his 2 legs. I think it was Captain Haywood. I didn't believe him. I said, "Don't be bloody silly, how can you break 2 legs?" But he had broken 2 legs. Then he said, "I've broken 1 leg." I thought, well, that's fair enough, but 2 legs. But it was true. We took him to the doctor, and the doctor said, "Oh, no, won't have anything to do with it, I'm sorry. If the Germans catch me, they'll shoot me." So I pulled down my gun, I said, "Look here, the Germans might shoot you in 2 or 3 weeks' time. Now, if you don't do this job, I'm going to shoot you now." So he chose to fix up our friend. And I was surprised, 2 legs, it seems a bit much, doesn't it?
So, you landed precisely where?
Well, a place called Anse, which is about 30 kilometres from Lyon. And the whole thing went wrong. The reception committee wasn't there. They'd already been arrested by the French police. So, as soon as I jumped, I saw it wasn't a proper place, because there were Polish pilots, and apparently the Poles didn't care where they dropped you, I was told afterwards. What they saw was a light from the railway station. So they said, "Come on, right, off you go, jump." So I arrived on this small field, which obviously wasn't a reception committee's choosing, buried my parachute, nobody to receive me. Then I saw a light about 200 yards away. I thought, "Oh, maybe they're there, the reception committee's there." So I walked towards the light, and it was a police station. But before I got to this particular place, I saw my friend who had jumped after me, coming down this little country lane. Suddenly, five policemen were in the ditch, three on one side, two on the other. They jumped at him and got him, you see. Well, I had a gun in my hand, but I wasn't a very good shot. And I thought, I've only got six bullets in the gun. There's five of them there. I'm sure to miss them. So I went the other way. And I had to walk to Lyon, 30 kilometres. And it was quite funny because I hid my suitcase. I thought I'd better not walk with a suitcase. And all the way to Lyon, there were police on motorbikes rushing down to this little village called Ars. They'd been alerted and they were looking for me. But as I said, little Frenchman walking along the road there, they didn't take any notice, you see. It was funny, when I got, just before Lyon, I got a tram to go to the centre of Lyon, and people talking in the tram, oh, do you know what happened last night? There's some British people parachuting to France. Of course, it's quite funny to listen. But the thing was, I didn't know where to sleep. You see, it's very dangerous. Well, although I know France, it's still dangerous to go to hotels. And didn't know what to do, so I went into a cafe, and a prostitute came up to me. Started talking, and she said, would you like to come with me? So I thought, well, this is an opportunity. So I went to her room, and I said, look here, I've come a long way. And of course I had a few hundred thousand francs around my waist. So I said, I've come a long way, here's a couple of hundred francs, do you mind going and sleeping somewhere else? So she was quite happy. She went and fetched some other clients, you see. But I got rid of her and I was able to have a good night's sleep. Next morning, I went and had a shave at a barber's place, and I said, I'm looking for a room. He told me where to go, a place called Place de Terreau. They had a notice in the window, and I saw a room to let à la Croix-Rousse. So I went and I got a room. Two old ladies there, they were letting rooms, and I got a room there. So, and of course, I had no contacts. I didn't know what to do. Also, I had no... The contacts were supposed to supply me with the carte de ravitaillement to get some bread and my eat. And when you went to eat in a restaurant, you had to have a carte de ravitaillement. The waiter would cut off 100 grammes de pain, 100 grammes de matière grasse, and all that sort of thing, meat, 100 grammes de viande. So I didn't know what to do. Eventually, I plucked up courage and went to the town hall to get my cards. But my name was Robert Léger. So the man said, oh, you're late, because it goes by alphabetical order. He said, you're 3 days late. That's all. He said, don't do it again. And he gave me my card. So I went straight to a restaurant, had a good meal. I'd had nothing to eat for 3 days except strawberries and cherries. Went and had a good meal. As soon as I entered this restaurant, whom should I see but two blokes from SOE having lunch. It's rather a coincidence. One of them I knew. I'd done training with him.
Can you remember their names?
Yeah, well, just the name, Gervais and Henri. That was, I never knew that. We never knew each other's surnames. Henri, he was killed by the Germans. Gervais, he's still alive, I think. And so I just, according to our training, I went in front of the table, dropped my newspaper on the floor, picked it up, looked them in the eye, and he recognized me. And I went to the next room and had a coffee, and he followed me and put me in touch with the organization, which was practically non-existent. The organization was called Le Coq Enchaîné. It was started and led by Louis Pradel, who was mayor of Lyon. He's also dead now, died of cancer. Louis Pradel, P-R-A-D-E-L. But you see, they bluffed London. I don't know if London was really bluffed, but they sent messages to London, we have 10,000 men. So they thought, well, Nicolas, he's a good chap, we'll send him to take over. The man who jumped with me, he was supposed to go to Paris on a mission. Of course, he wasn't able to go because he was caught. With a British agent who was in Lyon before me. Well, he's the man who bluffed London, I suppose. He sent messages, we have 10,000 men, send arms, etc. So they sent me to take his place. But there were no 10,000 men. There were about eight. We had dinner, and there were about eight or ten of us. That's all there was. Why they said they had 10,000 men, they published pamphlets, or the truck we call them in French, anti-German pamphlets, which they published once a month and distributed in 10,000 letterboxes. So they said, we've got 10,000 men, we want the arms, we want this. So it was a bit of a disappointment, but anyhow I started and I got them organized and received receptions, you know, received drops from parachuting.
How did you get them organized?
Well, as I say, there was 8 or 10 of us there. So two of them were very, very keen. The very next day, we started looking for dropping zones. And then these friends, they had other friends, and eventually I was able to get a few people together and give them training. And towards the end of 43, well, not towards the end of 43, but middle of 43, I left in just after June. We did start a maquis at Cluny, about, I don't know, about 50 miles from Lyon, Cluny, place called Cluny, C-L-U-N-Y. You know, they were already, the Germans were taking people for travail obligatoire, compulsory labor, and we started this maquis to get the young men away. He didn't want to go to Germany. And then I left in the middle of 43, and they sent somebody to take my place called Barthélemy, his name was. I think he's dead too. Then they're all dead, you know. I'll soon be the only one left. Barthélemy was his name. You've got a book here. I don't know if you'd be interested to read it. It's called Essai in France by Michael Foote.
Yes,
I know. Gives you all the names that you... A couple of pages about me too, which are quite nice.
Is it accurate, what he wrote in the book about you?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Very nice. Actually, he mentioned how security-minded I was. That was my biggest, strongest point. And that's
was that true?
Oh, yes. That's why I'm still here. That's why I wouldn't go to parties. I wouldn't go with women, even.
Can you you told me about your invitation to go to a party off record. Can you repeat it now on record?
Yes, well, I had orders to send back to England two men here in Lyon called the Newton Brothers. They had nothing more to do in France, and I received orders to send them back through Spain. So I gave them money, fixed up a guide, and they said, oh, hooray, we're going back to England. They were quite happy. We're going to have a party. Are you coming and join us, Nicola? I said, no, I don't go to parties. Oh, you're a bloody square, you are. I said, well, I'm a bloody square, but I'm still here, and they were caught.
How were they caught?
Well, different versions, but what I know is that they had a party and made so much noise, the neighbours called the police, and they were taken away. They eventually finished up in Mauthausen. Of course, they went through Klaus Barbie, who beat them up a bit.
Once you were in the area, did you know the name Barbie?
Oh, yes. Yes, quite well known, yes. I never met him, of course, but I was chased a couple of times by his men.
Can you tell me how that happened?
Well, we tried to organise an escape from the prison, I forget the name of the prison now, where my friend Shepherd, Bob Shepherd, he's the man who jumped from me, he was there. Then I had a man called Duris, who had worked for me. He was a driver, he had a lorry, and he used to take stuff for me, one place to another. And we tried to arrange an escape. So I was called at 3 o'clock in the morning by the police, and I said, what are you doing this time in the morning? I said, oh, there's a train to Marseille at 3 o'clock, and I'm just going to the station. Well, they searched me, and they found, coup de poing américain, was it? An aqueduct in my pocket. Ha-ha! Mon ami, come with us to the police station. As soon as they mentioned the word police station, I just turned around and ran. Well, they didn't catch me. I ran very fast. And by the time they were on bicycles, actually. By the time they got on their bicycles, they ended the thing to get the revolvers out and started shooting. Well, I'd done 100 yards. They didn't catch me. The second time was a little more dangerous. I had a flat, the first flat I had in Lyon, La Croix-Rousse. I moved to another flat. I had three flats, so I could go from one to the other. And this particular flat I just kept as a depot for my explosives. And I used to go there now and again once a week to, with a suitcase to take some explosives to do the teach the French people how to use the explosive. And so one morning I went there about 10 o'clock, opened the door, and I saw the landlady there talking to a man. Oh, I thought this could be the Gestapo. So I shut the door very quietly and went away. I had a few jobs to do. And I thought, oh, I'm being a bit nervous for nothing. I had heard from the landlady that the owner of the building was going to do some repairs. I thought that was probably the owner having a look around. So I went back about 12 o'clock, And the stupid Gestapo, who were in there waiting for me, they'd put the thing on the door, the bolt on the door. So as I put my key in the door, couldn't open it. Ah, I thought, hello. Probably was a Gestapo, and the landlady is worried and frightened, and she's put the bolt on the door. So I knocked at the door. Madame Gutmann, that was the name of the woman, she came from Alsace-Lorraine. Her name was Gutmann. I knocked a few times, and then slowly the door opened, and of course a man appeared, short, stocky built. I thought, hello, Gestapo. I took a step back, and he shut the door behind him, but intuition, I felt that there was another man behind the door. I just felt that. Made a step forward, I made a step backward, step forward, and I got to the head of the staircase, which was on the third floor of this flat. Then he went to hit me. Well, I saw it coming. I was featherweight champion of Kenya for 3 years, and I just ducked, he fell, which is quite comic, really. He fell. As he fell, I kicked him in the head, in the face. He got hold of my shoe, and at the same time, the other man came, who was hiding behind the door, and started shooting. But I ran down the stairs, and I don't know what you'd call that in English, escalier en colimaçon.
Snail?
Snail.
A spiral.
A spiral staircase. As I ran down, I mean, it's very hard to hit a man running away. So I got into the street, and this particular part of Lyon is very old, and you crossed the street, and you went down some steps, and you found yourself in another street. So, of course, they never got me. I lost my hat and my shoe, and I went to some friends working for me, and the man was a shoemaker. So he gave me another pair of shoes, and that was the end of that. But after that, I thought, well, they offered a reward for me. They had they took a photo, what do they call it, a photo kit?
Identity kit
of me. It was published, and they offered about £20,000 reward. Went to Paris. I had an uncle in Paris. He made me a nice hairpiece, and I grew a moustache. Went back to Lyon. I thought, well, I'm quite safe now. Walked down the high street in Lyon. All at once, a woman called, Monsieur Robert, Monsieur Robert. I thought, well, I'm supposed to be disguised. She crossed the road. She was a woman. Her brother was making keys for me. Oh, Monsieur Robert, you do look well. How are you? Of course I look well. I look 10 years younger. So I sent a message to London. I had trouble with the Gestapo. And now disguised, I can stay in France, but I think I should change district. So they sent a message back, and I went back to England by plane. They sent a plane at a place called Angers. 10 of us went back, all together. Went back, I think it was in August or September.
What was the pickup like?
Oh, it was very, very good. We met a man in Paris who told us to be at a certain spot in the field, gave a map reference at 11 o'clock on a certain night. And there was a guide, took us to the field, and apparently there were other people with other guides who were taking it from different spots. And we all met in this field about 11, 11.30. Unfortunately, the field was full of cows and horses. And what we did till 2 in the morning was to chase away the cows. And the horses didn't come back, but the cows kept coming back. They were nosy. And the plane didn't come till 2 o'clock in the morning. So we all got aboard, and there was Tony Brooks, I think he was on the plane. Can't remember the other name. There was a Frenchman and his girlfriend. There was 10 of us. So at 6 o'clock in the morning, all having breakfast with Colonel Buckmaster. That was fine. Good old English breakfast. No more continental breakfast. Bacon and eggs.
Did you come across...